Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It's always weird to do that after we've just recorded another episode, but hi, I'm James Jones. We're joined today by Mr. Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
And Mr. Guillaume Vaillette.
Hello.
It is December 23rd, 2021. We don't normally record an episode this week, but I don't know how much we want to talk about it. And I don't know. We had plans to not do so, and now we are. Things changed. But this will be our last episode, our last, at least main feed episode of 2021. This is the end of the year for us, so we will be taking the next week off. But if you are a subscriber to patreon.com/NWR, or if you just will miss our dulcet voices, you can go to patreon.com/NWR. I just said the address twice. And for $1 a month, access three, count them, three RFN Patreon episodes that we will have released in the last month, including one that will come out sometime after this one, but before the new year. So maybe not immediately after this one, but in the ballpark. So yeah, that's patreon.com/NWR. The three we've done so far. Oh my God. The one we just did was sort of a sequel to our video game memories around Christmas, or we've just sort of said media memories around the holidays. We talked about a lot of stuff. What's the one we did last week? I edited it. Oh my God.
Just the watching, the general watching omnibus.
Oh yeah. The what you've been watching one. And then before that, I don't know, that was 2 weeks ago. I don't have to remember these things.
That was GameCube of O2 Redux.
There we go. Our second pass at the Guess This Game. That was
our second journey into the Heart of Darkness.
It's a darker Heart of Darkness this time. This was the one that concludes with, I think it was me, declaring that we were one step from a review ending with, "This game makes me erect." And to be honest, it would have been perfect. If Guillaume found a review that said that, I would have been horrified, but it would have fit. So yeah, that's what you can go find at patreon.com/NWR, plus 26, 25 other Patreon episodes. We've done a bunch of them now. For $1 a month. I neglected to say that this is episode, I don't remember. Uh-oh, I had it written down. Things are going poorly.
752.
Look, I've not been working for a week. My brain's been shut off. 752, there we go. The most important episode since 751. Our plan for this week is primarily to focus on some email backlog and try to get that cleared out. You're going to do a very, very especially brief new business segment. I haven't done new business in a month. Like I said, I've been mostly just doing cleanup of stuff I've been playing for that whole time frame. I have beaten Lost Judgment. Again, not going to talk about it. I played a game off Game Pass after I finished Lost Judgment. I just wanted something else. And this is a game that was supposed to come out on... It came out last week on Xbox and PS4, I think, and playable on PS5. It's on the Game Pass service. It was supposed to come out on Switch as well, but at the last minute, they delayed that version to January 28th, and it's also on PC. And this is Record of Lodoss War, Deedlit Wonder Labyrinth Adventure or something like that. So many words in that name. I'm definitely up to Wonder Labyrinth correct. It's after that part where things get out of hand. Hold on, let me make sure I get it right. Deedlit in Wonder Labyrinth. There we go. So what this game is, so I guess let's give a little bit of context here. I'm going to give very little context. Record of Lodoss War is a media property in Japan that I believe started as some light novels, which are, you know, just not super... I mean, that you can figure out from the name what light novels are. It's a series of them. Standard high fantasy fare. So all your Tolkien races sort of filling the roles that he has blazed for them, reflected through sort of a more pop culturalist high fantasy. It's done this thing that Japanese media brands can do when they start as like a light novel. And then there's like an OVA, which is just a code word for saying it's a really short series, original video animation. Usually just means it was made for sale at retail and not for airing on TV. It's usually like 3 episodes or 4 episodes. It's not super long. Or 1 episode. There have been all kinds of games made, usually on a really, really low scale, like not very expensive games, comics, et cetera, et cetera. There's not, it's hard to say, like, what's the core media property? It's not like this is a TV show that spun off a bunch of other stuff. I guess nominally you could say it's the books, but eh. I don't know if that's anybody's primary. I don't even know if the books are translated into English. So
I just remember at the beginning of the DVD days and when I was starting college, like I was discovering anime, and that was one of the sets that I would see. And I rented it once and kind of quickly lost interest in it. It did not seem to be like particularly inventive or anything.
No,
it was popular though.
It made the rounds. It was popular. It's high quality production of its era, and it is. I think some of the characters are kind of fun. Like I only have vague recollections of it, but yeah, it's definitely, like I said, this is standard pop culture inflected high, you know. I mean, it's Baron and Luthien through a pop culture lens. Like, we have, although I guess the roles are technically reversed. We have the female immortal elf who falls in love with the somewhat disinterested human mortal knight, which is obviously the inflection of that role. But down to the literal chasing them through the forest scene, I believe, shows up. This, you don't need to know a lot. Like, there's a bad guy. And then the so-called Knights of Lotus, of which these two are members, as well as like your standard high fantasy classes of like, there's a monk who does healing, or a cleric who does healing. There's a wizard. There's a dwarf who throws axes. Like, it's, you know, it's, you're, we're not, we are not blazing any trails here. Form up a party and then fight for the good kingdom against the bad guy, and that's your plot, and that's basically what all this really comes down to. And it's mostly, at least from what I've observed, it's mostly about getting the opportunity to write some of these characters. It is really more the focus of anything. This one, Deedlit is the name of our elf princess, who has fallen in love with this human knight who is mostly interested in swords and doing cool things with swords. And this game takes place at, like, the only thing out there for canon is there was a big war. The good guys won, but our knight friend Parn is dead. And so this is sort of picking up what she's doing some number of years later. Still sort of coping with the curse of being immortal when people you care about aren't. But what the game is, improbably enough, is a 2D Metroidvania. And if
a genre that you love.
Yeah, so that's the thing. If I'm talking about one of these things, and it's me talking about them, I don't know if that means it's good or it's probably terrible, and my taste is garbage. I actually didn't really remember any of the plot of this series until I went back and did a reread. I read like the Wikipedia summary. And that kind of brought the stuff back. It basically just comes off as people saying weird, nonsensical stuff to one another if you don't have that, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter. It's more of the Castlevania style, very action-oriented RPG. So, like, she levels up as she goes. You find items to gain new skills, but it's not like Metroid where you get a ton of new skills. It's mostly like, you have a double jump. Now you have a double jump with an extra little glide. Extra little oomph. So we're focused on finding weapons, and she's got a bow and she's got a sword, and finding different weapons. They have different stats. So there's like every weapon has a how much damage it does stat and a speed stat, which is exactly what it sounds like. But there's things that aren't really part of the stat, like the swords, or sometimes they're pikes. Sometimes they're like big pole axes. Obviously the pole axes don't swing very fast. There's a chainsaw. It's not really a chainsaw, but it looks like kind of like a chainsaw. They have different shapes of the attack, too, and the animation of how they come out and stuff like that. So it really is about trying to figure out the right mix of power, speed and what works for how you want to play as her. But really, it's more focused on the fighting because the game is a Metroidvania, but it's not super involved in terms of like puzzle solving and like remembering to come back with the thing that you found, because pretty much every section, there's actually like level. They actually will come up with like a little screen when you transition into them. That'll be like level 2 or where you transition into the first time. Every one of those is self-contained. Now you can cross between them, and as you find keys in the game, a lot of time what keys do is they don't open progress, they open backtracking opportunities, or they give you things you can go back and get that weren't accessible before, rather than remembering, oh, my double jump now is useful because I can solve this puzzle. There is some of that. But because the game's relatively short, and you can pretty much navigate from one end of the map to the other in a few minutes, once you have unlocked all the doors and stuff. And there's a pretty good fast travel system. It works on warp room stuff. It's not asking you to remember when you get the double jump, you have to come back here. You can look at the map and see that, oh, I was only able to reach the bottom half of that room or the bottom square of that room. I bet now that I have a double jump, I can get higher. But primarily, you're solving the problems in a relatively linear path in these literal color-coded levels on the map. It'll be like, level 2 is the green area, and the background's different. It's got different music. You know when you've crossed. And they all end in a boss fight. And the boss fights feel pretty good. And when you level up, they feel like you're absolutely curb-stomping the boss. And that also feels really good. It's got a Ikaruga-style mechanic, too, where she has two espers that she uses, and this is canon from the material. One's fire, one's wind. And they both level up. And as you level them up, you do more damage, and they max out at level 3. But if she gets hit, she loses a level on whichever one she's using. And she can swap back and forth between them. Some enemies aren't vulnerable to... Some enemies are only vulnerable to one of them. And some enemies, their attacks you can absorb if you are currently equipped with the same one. You just tap the shoulder button and swap. And it swaps really fast. And she heals as long as she's in level 3 of whichever one you're currently using. But the only way to charge the other one is to, like, if you want to charge up fire, it's like level 2 right now. You want to get to level 3. You have to be using wind, which sometimes puts you in the awkward position of, like, I have to use the wrong one for the current situation. Because I need to get the other one charged up, because you do more damage with it when it's level 3, and you heal when it's level 3. And that healing turns out to be super important. And then there's some puzzle solving that comes with being equipped with the right one, but it's pretty light. I think what I like about this one is it's quick. You constantly feel like you're making progress. There's not a ton in the way of puzzle solving to do. There's a little bit. But it's more like I'm looking at this blade and I can move it around. Like, I can crank this gear to get it to move out of the way, but then it's going to fall back down. So what's the right way for me to have it come down so that I can pass through it before it comes back down and kills me? It's a lot of that more than like, what's the item I need to get through here? When you don't have the right jumping item, you could just come in the room and go, nope, can't jump that high. All right, come back later. But pretty much any time you encounter something like that for progress, the item you need is in that same section with you. Like, it will be the item you find in that level. And when you find it, that jumping area is the path to the boss for it. I cleared the game in about 6 hours, roughly. There's some pretty fun boss fights. I would say 16-bit era boss patterns. You know, they might have 5 or 6 attacks. They might have a second phase that they drop into where the patterns get changed up and they introduce a couple new ones. There's a fight where you fight all of her compatriots from the core material. So they each have like 3 patterns. So that makes it even more of kind of an interesting fight, because if you lose sight of what they're doing, you might find yourself suddenly getting blasted by a big energy wave. Like I said, she has a bow and arrow, which uses magic, but is super useful for keeping enemies at a distance. She has a sword, which requires you get up close, but can do a shitload of damage. And then she can find spells in the world that also use MP, and they have different levels of variability, of variable usefulness. I actually only used the best one in the final boss when I was came back and replayed it again. Because after I beat the game, it unlocked the boss rush mode where you fight all the bosses on one life in the same room. And I popped the big spell on him, and that was really satisfying because it did an absolute ton of damage. But yeah, this game is actually, I had a good time with it. And I don't usually like these kinds of things. I think the big deal for me was that it was, it's my Metroid Prime 3 thing where the game really kept me going on the right path. I didn't have to kind of learn where stuff was. I was able to just keep pushing through and get to the destination. And I always felt like I was making progress. You know, I was clearing a chapter, a sitting. You know, a sitting might be 40 minutes, an hour. And I was able to move on. Visually, this game looks really good. It looks like a Neo Geo game. I think it's probably the best way of describing it. It's kind of animated one, like one. It's got the blocky pixels from a Neo Geo game. The levels have nice detail. There's nice color. The characters animate really well. And it just feels good. The button layout's kind of weird, but you can remap it. But yeah, I think it's the same thing with Hollow Knight, where like I'm able to enjoy the game because it feels so good. It feels incredibly tight. And I got really good at the combat in it. So I was I had a good time with it. So yeah, if you've got Game Pass, definitely give it a shot. Like I said, I think it's like 6 or 7 hours. It's pretty short. I had a really fun time playing it, and like I said, it took, you know, if it's on Game Pass, it's free. If you only have a Switch, you know, it's coming out the end of January. So if you like these kinds of games, keep a lookout for it. I'll be curious how it reviews, because I could see people who are more hardcore fans of this kind of stuff actually being like, well, this one's pretty straightforward. I don't know. But to me, the combat was really what was keeping me interested. And the boss fights being as fun as they are. I mean, there's a big, you know, if you remember Neo Geo games, you'd have these boss fights against like huge giant dragons that take up 2/3 of the screen. There's a lot of that. And that's really fun. Just like absolutely spamming swords into this dragon's face and then switching to the fire mode to absorb his fire attack and just keep hitting him.
And those dragons, of course, are composed of multiple sprites that are all kind of moving together.
Yeah, it looks really cool. It's
like a paper puppet or something.
Yeah. But it looks like a Neo Geo game, but obviously they've got way more power to play with. So they've done some stuff that the Neo Geo couldn't do. But there's even like rotating sprite animations during some transitions. Like they really went for a style, and I dig it. So yeah, and there's some decent music in here too. So yeah, give this one a look. I had a good time, and coming from me, that might either mean it's a terrible game because I don't like these, or it really speaks to how good it is. We'll find out when we get your response. Anyone else want to do any new business, or we want to move straight to email?
Yeah, no, I'm in the final area of Shin Megami Tensei 5, so next time.
Cool.
Yeah, they're right. Very, very similar for myself.
Cool. All right, well then, email it is. You can send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. That's rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I will read the first one. David writes, "Hi, RFN crew." He actually says, "Hey, RFN crew." "I know how much you love video game anniversaries." And then he puts in quote, "especially Guillaume."
Mm-hmm. Did I mention that on the podcast? Or I don't know. I say a lot of things.
I think it's in the past you've sort of rolled your eyes at certain anniversaries getting trotted out as being significant when, you know, it's debatable how significant they are.
There are some people I've muted on Twitter because they just systematically mention whenever it's the anniversary, quote-unquote, of any game, like 32nd anniversary sometimes of like some game, and it's like, okay. But also, like, I've also muted the word anniversary So if I've been not reacting last time you tweeted about your anniversary or something, about something that's actually meaningful, I apologize. I just didn't see it because video games and other things have ruined this for me.
There was some game recently that was like, oh, it's our 26th anniversary. And I'm like, get the fuck out of here with the shit. Sonic is having its 25th anniversary right now, and like all their big projects are missing the year. So that's cool.
Yeah, there's movies. I mean, I know what you mean, but the movies are probably reaching more people than, most of the games ever would.
Yeah, but I think this is the 25th anniversary. Didn't the movie come out last year?
There's a new one that's coming out.
It's coming out next year.
Yeah, with sexy Knuckles.
No, it's not true. But no, my point is it also missed the 25th anniversary. So yeah, good things are happening. But yeah, anyway, 2022 will mark the 30th anniversary of the Kirby series. Apart from a new 3D Kirby game, do you think Nintendo and HAL will celebrate the 30th birthday of everyone's favorite pink puffball? What products would you like to see released for the occasion? Could the long-awaited Kirby-Odama crossover finally come to fruition? Thanks, and keep up the great work. It's nice to have an email not end commemorating snow.
So, I would question, again, as I would, of course, I would question the necessity of underlining the 30th anniversary of the Kirby series, especially since, like, if by celebration we mean releasing a product, I don't think that Kirby has ever stopped, that the, you know, HAL has ever stopped releasing
products.
It's been
one of the most consistent series for having, like, some kind of game pretty much on a yearly basis until... You know, most recently when it's kind of, kind of after Star Allies, I guess, and I guess just the development environment hasn't been so obvious on Switch, so sort of apt for like producing some small stopgap game as they've done in the past. But yeah, generally speaking, it's not something from the dim and distant past that we need to reconnect with.
Yeah, not exactly. A new anime, maybe? Right back at you, too, or something. I don't know. I've never watched
right
it.
Back at you. I don't know.
Hmm.
It is harmfully inoffensive is the best way of describing Kirby right back at you.
I see. I saw someone tweet about how their younger nephew talked about Kirby as like that toy from the Happy Meals. Basically.
Oh damn.
The kid had gotten a Happy Meal, like a right back at you Happy Meal, and thought that it was just a toy, and didn't know about the show, and thought that's where the character came from the Happy Meal.
That's sad.
So I don't know, but maybe they do need to commemorate Kirby's 30th anniversary.
Well, they did a certain amount for the 20th. If we go 10 years ago, we had a few things. I think there was like a... concert album, you know, they did a sort of symphony, retracing some of the kind of musical highlights. The music of Kirby is generally, you know, sort of held up as one of its highlights, and they've had pretty, there has been some range of composers over the years, but it's been relatively rather consistent with the main two kind of composers that have worked on it throughout. So, you know, you kind of got, the music has evolved, but equally, you know, it's got some kind of, there's a through line there for you to kind of work with making a product like that. Then there was the Wii collection. Of Kirby games that was very much more like it as opposed to what they did with the Mario anniversary with just the Super Mario All-Stars ROM on a disc scenario.
And a booklet.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, like you say, that was for the 20th anniversary. Like, no, that wasn't 10 years ago. You're probably wrong.
I regret
to
inform
you. Can't have been that long.
I regret to inform you that it is... It is
upon us, basically.
See, I guess this is the peril of ignoring anniversaries.
Yeah, yeah. See, 2022 was 15 years ago, Guillaume. That's where you're at.
The key thing about it was, unlike just, yeah, you know, I mean, you know, this, there wasn't like a Kirby All-Stars exactly that they could just re-release in that way. Maybe if there had been, they would have been that lazy. But to be fair, I didn't own it, but all the different things it did in terms of collating a number of games across like different formats. You had Game Boy games, you had the console games as well, you know, N64, and then you also, because it was just after, yeah, very shortly, because the very end of 2011 was Kirby's return to Dreamland, and it essentially had like some of those kind of power up challenge levels from Kirby's return to Dreamland, but new ones just for this collection, and it had a museum and like all sorts of things. So they seem to treat it, you know, with some level of kind of reverence and effort then. So I don't know what that says about the 30th. Does it say, well, we did that, so it's like not, we don't need to do it again? Or how would you do it now? I mean, I suppose one of the big questions is, you know, will 2022 be the year where we get some kind of portable representation on NSO, whether it's through the baseline package or the expansion pack? Obviously Kirby's history is so bound up in portable games that, you know, it would kind of make sense to some extent, maybe, if you could say, you know, here's Kirby's Dream Land 1 and 2 on the original Game Boy, you know, here's, you know, some of the Game Boy Advance games, you know, that if you could maybe have like might not be a sort of a product that you'd buy necessarily, but you know, it could be like a kind of a schedule of where, you know, Kirby games are released across the different NSO platforms or something. I guess there are different ways of kind of doing that now, rather than just like, oh, here's a disc with, you know, a museum behind it and stuff like that. Like you have other options now, I suppose. But generally, especially like the way they do stuff with, because Kirby music actually does tend to get more aggressively kind of released and sold in Japan anyway.
They had an album for that, Kirby Cafe.
Yeah, the Kirby Cafe, and that anniversary concert back then, and you know, the just the soundtracks of the games and stuff. Like, I'd be surprised at the very least Japan will get some sort of special CD for it, I can only imagine.
David in his email writes, like, apart from the new 3D Kirby game, isn't a new 3D Kirby game celebration enough for 30th anniversary? Finally, Kirby makes a move to 3D. Yes, I know. I'm not trying to erase Kirby's 3D Blowout Blast, but yes, it was not a full-fledged Kirby game.
You just wanted to get 3D Blowout Blast in, and I applaud you.
But like, this is a big deal. An entirely new 3D adventure, and one that has been kind of teased and, like, you know, has been attempted but was never released. So finally they managed to find a way to make Kirby 3D, and we're going to be playing that soon. I think that's pretty special in and of itself. I don't need more.
There'll be elements within that game that feel like they're celebrating that. I mean, oftentimes Kirby games do kind of return to elements of the past classics, and you know, it's kind of they do. even the like spin-offs like Epic Yarn, you know, like the final world is Dreamland.
Has it been confirmed that we're going to fight a giant tree in the next 3D game, or no?
We will fight a giant tree.
I've been checking every day, and it's yet to be confirmed. I think it's pretty safe. Yeah, you would have thought in some three-dimensional way that emphasizes the fact that this is not your normal fight with the tree. I mean, it's a big deal. I guess you could argue maybe it's not the most apt way for an anniversary in that. It's relatively progressive for Kirby. Okay, that's the thing with the 20th anniversary. You were just coming off Return to Dreamland, which was very much a renaissance for classic Kirby. It was just very traditional side-scrolling Kirby, but with the kind of polygonal graphics kind of up to that standard for Wii and then 3DS, and especially Triple Deluxe and Robobot, all three of those. I liked them a lot. Mm. I thought they were really good. This 3D game, again, it has, by its nature, presumably, a lot more capacity to alienate, presumably, if it doesn't quite land well with the kind of Kirby enthusiasts. But I'm happy that they're willing to take a chance and kind of try and adapt it in some sort of way, because it, as wonderful as those games are, you kind of feel like if you just kept making them, you'd be spinning your wheels at a certain point. But this is so much, there is a lot of Kirby history, that wasn't covered, in that 20th anniversary, presumably because it was relatively recent history at the time, or even stuff that's come after it, stuff like the Canvas Curse and Rainbow Curse. Obviously Canvas Curse existed back in 2012, but it wasn't particularly retro, sort of 7 years old. And Rainbow Curse came later on Wii U, and it's one of the relatively few games that has not escaped, the Alcatraz of Wii U at this point. If you're left on it, it feels like Alcatraz, but presumably many fewer escapes from the real one, I would say. But it doesn't seem like it's going to get off the island, is the point, sadly. But maybe a 30th anniversary could, although it's, when did that come out? 14? Was that something like that?
Hmm.
So it's that retro, is it? It's only as retro as Canvas Curse was back then, so it's not, it may run into a similar problem. There were a lot of Kirby games in the last 10 years, and there were a lot of work covered there, so I think there's room to do it. I guess it's just like, will there be the kind of, the right vector for it?
No, both Mario and Zelda have gotten a Game & Watch commemorate their anniversaries. And, of course, Kirby, there's never been a Kirby Game & Watch game. He's never been part of even the Game & Watch collections. It's been exclusively Mario Affairs.
Good news, because the Game & Watch games don't seem to worry about whether or not their character has...
No, but I kind of wonder, would this be... my wish, I don't think it's going to happen, but my wish would be that instead of a, the Game & Watch format, they would give you, a few Game Boy Kirby ROMs on a Game Boy-shaped device. But
yeah.
I don't see it happening for Kirby, because Kirby, it's a Nintendo property, but is it?
It's not on that first tier.
No. And also with how they do, there is some independent kind of ownership of it, which is why the licensing is different, for that stuff, even with the way they handle the music in Japan and stuff.
But Kirby is definitely, its home was on Game Boy, so it would be fitting, but because of politics, I don't think it's going to happen.
Although, really, it's not... it's because, they didn't even... there are Super Mario and Zelda Game & Watch things, and they completely ignored those actual games when they made it. So, to be honest, the Kirby Game & Watch in the style of the ones we actually got for Mario and Zelda is not particularly less valid. You could still do it, but it is maybe you've just stepped over the line of it being too much of a kind of mismatch at that point. But anyway, that we could get some of these portable games coming back would be good, because Kirby 64 is a known title for the expansion pack. I mean, that would certainly be one, and of course we already have stuff like Kirby's Dream Land 3 and Superstar on Super Nintendo, with Switch Online, Kirby's Adventure for the NES Switch Online. So it's not as if there isn't already some out there, but definitely because it's so inextricably linked with Nintendo's portables, and because Nintendo's portables have thus far been kind of ignored in the retro sort of stuff with Switch Online, is underrepresented as a result. And you've even got, you know, your spin-offs like Kirby's Pinball, back to the Odama point, the Breakout one, the Kirby Breakout, yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, sorry, I knew the title a second ago, and I don't anymore. Blood Ball.
Blood Ball, yes. And then, I think at one point there was a rumor going around, at least, or it was teased in some way, that the people who made Metroid Prime Pinball and Super Mario Ball, or whatever it was called, you know, the Fuse games, were possibly going to work on a Kirby pinball game, but it never materialized.
So I have a thought on what they could should will do on the anniversary. So I'm taking keys from what they did with Mario, less what they did with Zelda. I think it's a little bit different. I think it's time for us to get our Kirby Battle Royale. 30 Kirbys drop very slowly from an airplane.
If they feel like it. If they don't, yeah. They can just float back up.
Very, very slowly from a warp star. There we go. Onto an island full of enemies that they can then pick up skills from, because, of course, that's what Kirby does, and eliminate one another. The thing is, this sounds like a very stupid premise.
Maybe it could be more like Battle Royale, the film from Japan in 2000, ooh, in which the students are each furnished with one weapon before they are sort of, you know, left to their own devices on the island. And so, like, you enter with a Kirby skill. And it might be rubbish. You know, it might be one of the low level ones. It might be one of the amazing ones. But
yeah, the sleeping cap.
One that only used once.
But it would, but you know, it might in some way be possible. You could pull off some unlikely sort of win against a fellow, you know, that you could take their power as Kirby, you know, is want to do. Or maybe you're almost more like Mega Man. You know, he's going to take that part and then use that to continue the rampage until there's only one.
See, I think the rule you have to keep in, though, is that he only carries one power, so you have to make the call. Do I want to keep a microphone, which is only good for two more pulls, yeah, but is absolutely devastating, or am I going to pick up Wheel, which is just chaos? Because imagine taking Wheel into a Battle Royale scenario, because Wheel is basically uncontrollable in a platformer meant to use Wheel. Put Wheel in, like, a 3D world? Oh, it's going to be a nightmare.
Yeah, it could also have some, like, Zelda Master Cycle type ramifications for the performance of the game.
You outrace the game's loading, which is my favorite thing to do in Zelda now. So obviously they've already got a 3D Kirby game, so that puts a damper on things. We haven't really seen much what that game is, though. And the reason is they're hiding the fact that it is a Kirby Battle Royale.
Oh, no. Well, it's got this sort of, post-apocalyptic sort of, vaguely kind of thing going on. So for what we've seen so far, so that's probably somewhat suitable for a Battle Royale scenario.
Well, it also points to kind of a more, like, you know, quote unquote mature audience that they're trying to reach. And it's probably,
I mean,
because
Kirby's already really mature.
Yes, but probably the game is kind of, you know, is going to tie in with the upcoming movie where, of course, Kirby is voiced by Chris Pratt.
Damn it.
I could see him saying hi in a really high pitched voice.
No, he's going to do his own voice. Don't worry.
No, that's what I say.
He's going to be kind of smarmy.
Yeah.
Hi.
It's like, yeah, except it's going to sound like Chris Pratt.
Yeah, well, yeah, obviously. But I can't do Chris Pratt's voice. I can do the way he says everything, which is like too cool for school. Kirby Too Cool for School is actually the name of
the new animated series.
Or the Battle Royale, or both.
Yeah, I like it for the fact, again, thinking of the Japanese film.
There you go.
It's pretty appropriate.
There we go. So that's how they're going to celebrate the anniversary of Kirby.
But where the word cool means forced to kill each other for instead of, what it appears to mean.
Cool means after rigor mortis has set in.
Yes.
Well, that's how we're going to celebrate Kirby's anniversary. And that's not like us just spitballing. That's actual insider information. So we could take that to the bank.
Mm-hmm.
Guillaume,
I was just going to say it's a safer bet than NFTs. Invest in RFN is what I'm saying.
1/22nd of the episode can be yours. Guillaume, would you read the next email?
Sure. Anonymous writes, after completing Metroid Dread, I had a tough time getting Metroid out of my system. So I found myself back on my mini Super NES playing through Super Metroid and decided to, for the first time in my life, go for the good ending. I've always thought about it before, but honestly, I have a hard time staying on track because I just can't ignore all those missile expansions and reserve tanks as I run by. But I finally did it, almost entirely from memory, and I have to say, I really enjoyed it, even if I would have liked a little extra health for some of the boss fights. Since then, I've gone back to Metroid Dread and completed a hard mode run, so hopefully I can move on with my life now. What's a game with a built-in goal, like Super Metroid's good ending, or harder difficulties, or a user-slash-community-created goal, something like pistol only in Resident Evil 4, that you didn't do when the game was fresh, but I've gone back to years later and enjoyed.
Yeah, this email, we did touch on this email a little bit where we did the Metroid Dread Stockholm Syndrome, topic, but there's overlap there, but this does have its own distinct question, you know, to be answered. So I think it was only fair that we came back to it.
Well, I tend to, if I'm going to fixate on a game, usually it's in the moment and or like in the years later, but like it's going to be continuous. I find it hard to go back to a game that I've played a lot before a long time ago. You know, like I can't quite go back to Super Mario World the way I used to. Yeah, like going back to a game and doing an objective that I never did before, it's not really like I tend to lose interest when I revisit the games that I used to love as a kid. So, but I fixated on some games like, when I started talking, I had an example in my head and now it's gone. So that's going great. But when I played like Chrono Trigger, I played Chrono Trigger for years or months at least. And I went through all the endings and I played through the game at least, I don't know, like 20 times, and I don't recall taking a break. You know, I didn't like splice in like a little game of this and that in between. It was like, okay, I finished Chrono Trigger. Well, time to start Chrono Trigger. So that's how I work.
Yeah, I know. Usually, if I'm coming, I will come back to things, you know, things I like, a fair bit, but it's generally going to be the case that it's like I played it more thoroughly the first time. And then it's like you're coming back in and it's like, okay, you know, maybe it's something that the first time you played it, you did it with, you know, 100% completion or, you know, on a harder difficulty or something. And then when you revisit it, you kind of do the more casual version of that, kind of enjoy it again. So it's not terribly common. There's a few things I can think of that somewhat qualify. I think I mentioned before, at least on the retroactive that was pertinent to this, F-Zero GX's story mode, kind of, I got just a certain point, I was just like, okay, you know, harder difficulties are not happening on this. And it was several months, maybe even more than a year later, that I kind of came back around. And, you know, I'm surprised it worked, because it really seems like the most logical thing there would be having not played it for a good while, is to go, oh, this is even harder than I remember. Okay, definitely not. Absolutely not. I'm not doing any more of this. But somehow I did get over the hump and end up doing all of that stuff on the hardest difficulties. And so that is really quite a rare case, I think, where it's like, for whatever reason, I kind of reached my limit at a certain point, but then actually came back and was able to surpass it later. But, other things I would say, some of it is just having the opportunity. I mean, with, like you mentioned, Super Mario World, the GBA version of Super Mario World, which obviously has a certain amount of compromises because it is on GBA, you know, the visible play area and the sound and stuff. But, it actually sort of let you track collecting the dragon coins, the Yoshi face coins in the level. So, yeah, whereas I must have played that game incredibly thoroughly, it was the first Super Nintendo game I had, and, you know, just this magical experience, and just played it many, you know, way beyond having the 96 exits and all that, just to keep enjoying the game, back then. I wouldn't have been able to say, did I get all those coins? I don't know. So it was like, it was cool to actually have that track now and be able to do it and say, yeah, there it is. I have, you know, kind of really, truly, thoroughly explored and played all these levels that I do know very well already.
This is definitively not how I play games, because when I play games, when I replay games, my focus tends to be on breaking them more and more thoroughly. So sort of the inverse of this, you know, I'll find a thread of, oh, I can destroy this game. And then I just start pulling on it. And I just follow it as far as I go. And I talked about this with Ogre Battle 64, where I guess this is the best example. When I did the retroactive, I had perfected a format of units through multiple plays of that game that is largely unstoppable. The final boss of the game can rough it up, but if you throw enough of them at it, you will eventually be successful. And they're almost mass producible. Like they're very straightforward to make. And once I more or less perfected the engineering of creating them, I could use them almost through like meiosis to create more of them through literal, just like divide them and make a new set. And so in that playthrough, all my playthroughs towards the latter half of those plays have become quite dry because that configuration is so good. And there's like two other minor flavors that I had in support roles. You know, I had effectively professionalized my military in that game. And in our retroactive, just to sort of give myself some more variety to talk through, I basically banned that formation from my usage, which is funny because I would find myself like slowly building it sort of by just through muscle memory and then would have to stop. Go, no, don't build that. Do this other step into the unknown. Do this thing you've never seen before. Let's see what happens. And so I did end up doing a little bit of that there, but basically I replay these games with the goal of getting faster, getting better, getting more and more destructive to the game's core mechanics. The ultimate expression of that is, and I've talked about it, when I realized that the play action fade in NCAA Football 04, they always bite on the play action. They always bite on it. Every single pass, they bit on it. And when you bite on when the entire secondary bites on the play action, and then you just heave it over the top to somebody running a straight vert, it pretty much ends in a touchdown as long as they complete the pass. And so I ran a season, and in 5-minute quarters, I ran a season of just that play. It's the only play I ever called. Because I wanted to see what would happen. And the answer was basically a lot of home run passes. And my wide receiver and quarterback were 1-2 in the Heisman voting because of their absolutely asinine numbers. I think the wide receiver won, so that tells you it's not realistic. but like, it was just the same guy catching the same pass play. Cause I was like, all right, AI, you will have to stop this eventually, right? No, they didn't. And so, like, I rode that straight to a number one and just kept hammering it because I just wanted to know. I didn't lose a single fucking game. I think I picked, like, two defensive plays. I think I picked a coverage play and then just a blitz everyone, including the secondary.
This feels like it was some sort of interstitial step to just get one of those, like, drinking birds to play the game for you.
Yes! Like, I mean, I basically was running a fireball blitz 90% of my defensive plays. It's just like only when it was like third down and 20, I'm like, okay, I'm going to put everybody in zone coverage. Because I would blitz 8 and get to the quarterback most of the time because the game doesn't encounter. The people making the game didn't contemplate some sick bastard moving blitz 8 to his primary defense and just running it.
Somebody doesn't remember Jerry Glanville's grits blitz defense, evidently.
I think he would have been looking at that going, the fuck is wrong with you?
Maybe.
But like it was really just how much...
We are talking about a man who publicly stated that he reserved a seat at Falcons home games for Elvis in case he needed it.
Seems fine. Seems perfectly reasonable.
I think
the only issue we had with our Heisman candidacy was because that I had so thoroughly busted. I mean, I really just realized that the game doesn't know how to protect against the fireball blitz.
Yeah. I've talked about it myself. There was problems in the early Madden games, just in terms of like if you had one of the better defensive ends in the game, you could block every punt.
Yeah,
exactly. That just sucks. Like, it's just not. So when you play in two play, you just had to agree amongst yourself. All right, I know you got Reggie White. We're not having every punt getting blocked. So just knock it off.
Just imagine this shit. Imagine if you turn on a football game at any level, like NIAA 2. And every single fucking play, they run a blitz 8 and get to the quarterback. You would just start to feel really sad halfway through the broadcast. You'd be like, this is upsetting. I hate this. Please stop doing it. And I'd be up by like 47-0 in the, keep in mind, 5-minute quarters.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
They're running out of yardage to stop to, cause, you know, they're punting from their own 5. So, like, I'm only getting 40 yards to work with anyway. And I'm still running this fucking thing. I'm like, no, I'm just going to grind your ass into the dirt. I think I had one guy with, like, 27 sacks. But that's what I do. It's just, like, I want to see what the edge of what the game can handle and then try to push through it, lest I want to make my life harder on myself and try to. I feel like sometimes pushing the game out beyond, you know, pushing the boat out beyond the horizon of what the designers thought some sick bastard would ever try to do to it can be its own challenge. But mostly it's just like, how much can I make myself cackle when Boston College is now on putting a wide receiver at quarterback because I blitzed the other ones off the field. It's like, oh, good. The AI's decided to put a wide receiver back there. This will go well. I think it's just a different perspective of what I want the game to be easier to the point where it's not even a game anymore. It's just I'm having fun watching it fall apart.
Yeah, it's more like the sort of, you know, media equivalent of somebody, you know, sort of taking insects apart under a magnifying glass or something. it's sort of cruel destruction of it until it doesn't really resemble itself anymore.
I mean, there is some super I had to let one of my players go in Super Mega Baseball 3 because it had gotten out of hand, and it was just like I was on my 4th title, I think, and I'm like, all right, I'm gonna let some players go, and rebuild a little bit, but I did put up 27 runs in one of the championship games.
I can think of the retroactives brought me back to something. I'm pretty sure there was quite a long gap. So it was a bit against the odds that I ended up ever doing it. But I played a great deal of GoldenEye, you know, on N64, the single player as well as the multiplayer. And for a long, long time, I'd never seen that final secret level the temple level that has, like, it's kind of a weird mishmash of Bond elements. You know, it's like it's got the golden gun in it, but it's also got, you know, Baron Samedi in it, and it's, you know, so it's, and it's the place, I think the location is from The Spy Who Loved Me, so that's like three separate Bond movies that it's kind of referencing there.
And of course, still running around is Pierce Brosnan.
Yeah, exactly. So if you make it four, I guess, but it's like, I think it was like a multiplayer level as well or whatever, but I never seen it in single player. And so, but eventually I did beat that. So I must have gone back. You're 008. I think you had to beat everything else in 00 agent in order to see that, which was quite a challenge, for me.
Yeah.
Anyway, with a, you know, sort of not particularly well developed sort of FPS skills of, back then. So that was something that, evidently I felt strong enough that even though you've gone well past the point of like, admittedly, you know, kind of acquisitions with N64 when you imported it, they were rare. Yeah, they were infrequent. So you got the most out of the game, to say the least. But I think, yeah, there must have been a period where it's like, okay, I'm moving on to other games. It's not happening. And then at some point I came back around and did actually see and beat that temple level. So yeah, that'd be a pretty big case because it was tough. The 00 agent really kind of put you to the test.
And look, most of the encounters in that game are not designed for 00 Agent. And 00 Agent is kind of this weird, it's kind of like Mario Kart 200cc, where it's like, this is not clear, it was clearly not designed for this. I am doing something, this thing was not meant to be done.
It was kind of funny, wasn't it? Because it added extra objectives. So it wasn't just like a damage health or enemy count thing. Like it was more substantially kind of complex, which was nice, but then actually doing it at that difficulty where, you know, the enemies were just more apt to kill you straight away and it was harder to sort of stay hidden. It was sometimes difficult to enjoy the sort of additional elements to the missions that difficulty involved. It was,
absolutely,
funnily enough, it was just something just today that I spotted that could count for this, because I was just sort of doing a little test with my TV setup, putting my Japanese Wii on, and I used Smash Brothers Melee to do it. And it's got that record of all the like milestones that you ever hit. So it's like, oh, you know, and it, funnily enough, it was the first one on there. It's like, oh, you cleared, you know, classic mode for the first time. And it was Christmas Day of 2001, you know, 20 years ago. But then I just scrolled through it. And at the end, there was something like, oh, you cleared classic mode on very hard with one stock or something. And it was from 2006. It was way after everything else. All the other ones are like, you know, 01 and then into 02 and then the odd one in 03. And then it's like, I don't even remember that at all. Cause I mean, this is, you know, we're getting into the Wii era by that point, but there you go. So I must have randomly at some point thought, you know what, Melee, I'm not quite done with you yet.
I do wonder, like, definitely there is some stuff in Smash Brothers where the achievements are like, do this thing that's completely nonsensical. And
some of those event matches in Melee, I mean, the very last one where it's like you have to fight Mewtwo, Ganondorf, and like Giga Bowser or something. It's like, wow, that was tough. That was really, really hard.
Now, there's some objectives around in the multi-man Melee where, I think it's fighting Polygon Team in that one.
Oh, like that reminds Super Smash Brothers for Wii U, the kind of challenge wall. You had to get seven kills in Cruel Smash. Oh my god! It was so difficult.
I think I got to four, and I feel like I was like, you know what? I've done enough. I have done enough. Four is getting four. Like the majority of times in Cruel Smash, the outcome is none.
No, it is very lives up to the name. Like those opponents are just out for blood from the off, and it, yeah, to be able to get any of them out is not easy by any means. Seven. Yeah, because with the challenge wall stuff, it's like some you can like basically just, you know, call in your kind of favor with those right. golden mallets that you kind of accrue. But I don't think you could with that one.
No, otherwise, you sure couldn't.
Surely I would have done it before with the amount of times it took to actually do that. Yeah, that was it. That's the thing with Smash Brothers. It just, you know, there's that little gnawing of like you want everything, and it's I'm not sure I did all the ones on Wii, because Wii is brought in that challenge wall thing, right? That was the first time that they did that, and I don't think I actually did all of that, but I guess yeah, with Wii U, even though it wasn't like fully portable, at least he had off TV play, so I think that did contribute to me spending more time doing some of the real edge case things in that game.
Yeah, there is one in Ultimate that was, it unlocks a spirit, and it was like one of the last spirits I needed. And we talked about it on the show at the time, where it was clear the last boss of
the
Ganondorf.
The world of light, and you've got to be Ganondorf and all that. Yeah,
and I did it. And then somebody said, hey, you know, you could have just turned the difficulty to easy. It still counts. And I went, what?
It's true. Yeah.
Son of a bitch.
The thing about that is it takes ages. Like with Cruel Smash, it's fast. Like it is over quickly. But so it's more crushing when you kind of get close to beating,
it's like 12 minutes,
that World of Light scenario, and you don't do it. But I would still say probably getting the Cruel Smash thing done was more painful.
Oh, it absolutely would have been. Yeah, Smash is probably the one place where I would do this stuff, because the game sort of designs it for you. I guess I actually there is one, and I'll stop after this. Perfect Dark.
I don't think I did everything in that. There was some real tough stuff there.
I did everything in that. And that included, after I did everything, putting myself up against Dark Sims. Which, that game, you could say like, oh wow, the AI is really good. No, Dark Sims just cheat.
Yeah,
like,
that's all it is. I'm sure it had to be. It wasn't cheat. On N64, it wasn't going to be that, you know, so nuanced that it's that effective. Right. You just brute force it.
Yeah, they're just cheating. And so, really, it wasn't. It was a bit like, what is the name of that movie? I'm blanking on what it is now. Where I'm basically on the island and hiding to get ambushes in, not trying to actually hunt them down and fight. So it would basically be, I would be in the hallway and I would put the laptop gun out, not because I thought it would do any damage, because it doesn't, because again, they just cheat. But that was my audio cue that they were coming. And I would put myself in a place where they couldn't get me coming out of the door and do some kind of bullshit to try to get them. And I might get one. That was it. I might get one. And because they would come through the door in waves, and it was all over at that point. But there was like a pride. And it was really like, once they knocked you out of your defensive post, you weren't getting back into one. Like they were just going to hunt you ravenously. So that was all I had. And it was like, I'm going to try to just take out two. That's my goal. I want two of these fuckers before they rack up the 10 kills. And I think at one point I got really, like, I managed to pop off like four or five kills before they got me. And I, in this best of 10, and I started having this thought of like, oh, I might win this fucking thing. I might actually beat these guys. And then they just absolutely roundhouse kicked me in the head over and over and over again. Just drilled me into the ground. It was like, well, shit. Because I think I was up like 6-0, and I'm like, oh, I've got him. I fucking got him. No. Absolutely. Like, they were not. They saw the score, and they're like, no, this isn't happening. This is not an outcome we're going to allow. And I just got dump trucked. And there, that was it. Like, I think I probably spent, I would guess I spent at least 10 hours, probably more, just fighting Dark Sims. Don't recommend it. It sucks.
It's, I guess again, you're kind of just testing the limits of it and of what these things will actually do in these kind of extreme circumstances. But yeah, there was like four extra levels, I think, rather than two, because two in GoldenEye,
yeah,
with the space shuttle one and the temple and then with Aztec and temple, that's what they were called. And with Perfect Dark, there were four, and I'm just not convinced I actually saw all of them, but it's been so long.
GoldenEye, I couldn't do it, and I eventually just Game Sharked the last one open. But Perfect Dark, I did do it. I don't remember how. I think I just brute forced it. I think I just kept trying because all I had was the N64. So, like, there weren't a lot of games available, especially that late in the N64's life. So obviously I just got through. But yeah, those levels are also a real pain in the ass. All right, Greg, would you read our last email of the year?
So all of a sudden I feel this tremendous pressure with this momentous occasion. Lomonade writes, "Dear RFN, Nintendo seeks your expertise as video game business experts. They want to revive HD Rumble. What do you propose they do? And don't isn't a valid answer."
Disagree.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it. I certainly thought, you know, that and the other Joy-Con stuff was a costly kind of gimmick that risked, like, you know, compromising the success of the system, adding to the cost, you know, for stuff that's kind of frivolous. You know, they'd already been down some of this kind of road with, you know, stereoscopic 3D on 3DS kind of did not help matters, and you know, put that in peril. I really felt like it was a lesson they should have learned, that this was sort of frippery that is added to the cost of the system and shouldn't really be focused on. But, you know, to be fair, Switch has done just fine, so, you know, they were kind of vindicated in that sense. And yet at the same time, that have not been particularly vindicated by how, you know, incredibly useful or fruitful having that feature has been for games over the life of the system. You know, and sadly, as time's gone on, you know, and I more and more just play with like the hoary split pads. I'm just like, just because it's more robust and it doesn't really come loose from that slightly wonky right Joy-Con rail that I've mentioned on here before. Even if games were having some great, you know, kind of revival of HD Rumble, I would be ignorant of it at this point.
All right. So I've got two. Do you want the insane idea or the insane idea? I'm going to give you the one that's normal insane, and then we'll get to the one that's extra business. So I talked about how I spoiled, really, what's coming with the Kirby 3D game, that it's actually a Kirby Battle Royale game to commemorate the 30th anniversary of Kirby. 30 Kirbys very slowly fall at their own speed from a Warp Star. So how they're going to use HD Rumble in this is, you know, normally in Kirby, when you die, you just sort of and you fly off the screen. Can't do that because then you'd be able to harvest their power. Otherwise, it would just turn into two Kirbys trying to suck one another. And that's not a phrase I want anywhere near anything related to this game. So you've got to be able to KO someone and then choose to effectively loot their body, which in the case of Kirby is literal.
Silo style from Heroes. You know, you're just going to open up the top of their heads and the question, toy with their brain.
So the question is, how do you do that? Well, the goal is when you beat them, when you actually KO another Kirby, you could take the Joy-Cons and reach out and squeeze, and you'll get like the feeling of squeezing something rubbery, because of course it's Kirby. If you go up and down, you'll get kind of this like slight resistance kind of feeling, like it'll feel like there's resistance in the Joy-Con, because I imagine Kirby's more rubbery than he is smooth, kind of like a gator skin ball, if you've ever held one of those. So there's like the coefficient of static friction of his body is actually quite high. So there's like a little bit of that, but if you reach out and grab to then decide to consume, you reach out, grab, pull him in, and that's how you very, it makes it feel more visceral. Like, I am absolutely taking his power and I'm taking his life force. But if you reach out and grab and squeeze, you'll feel the pulse on the Joy-Con as the life drips from Kirby's body. It slows down and gets weaker. And it starts at the top and pulses down. It sounds like
something Kojima would probably be doing with HD Rumble.
Well, that's the thing. That's the developer of this new Kirby as Kirby Battle Royale. It's Kojima Productions. Regret to inform you. Keep in mind, this is the less insane idea.
Yeah, with the Kirby played by Kiefer Sutherland, finally. We've all been waiting.
I mean, if that let's say they do the January Nintendo Direct, and now with our Nintendo Minute cast gone, we have some nondescript Nintendo person describing the feeling of the life dripping from a vanquished Kirby, that will absolutely get talked about. Like, no question, that will absolutely lead the internet discourse. And if you want to revive the Joy-Con, or the Joy-Con's
HD Rumble capabilities. HD Rumble.
It's like, this ain't no fucking ice in a glass, y'all. This is the only thing that got iced. The only thing that got iced here is that Kirby.
I'll say that you know, 1-2 Switch wasn't that great, but a great deal of the games were kind of meant to be played without even looking at the screen, and that's an idea that Nintendo immediately abandoned. And I think if you're going to try to revive HD Rumble, it's where you need to go. You need to kind of try to dig deeper, that idea, that concept of video games as, you know, just games. Forget the video part. You know, the screen is optional. I don't know what you can do with the HD Rumble to make it like a satisfying game experience, but you see, you know, like, well, sometimes you see like able gamers, like, you know, like disabled people, like playing, finishing Castlevania game with just using their shin because that's, you know, what they can move. Or I don't know, like people can do things that you wouldn't believe possible when, I don't know how to phrase this. Like when they, with the means that they have, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I can't imagine that it's impossible to design a game that would just use HD Rumble as kind of the feedback interface.
Well, it makes me think of Sound Voyager, the Bit Generations game, which I think is one of the only Bit Generations games that didn't come back as
No,
it's obviously pretty. There's not that much there. It's very thin, but you know the whole idea is I mean, there are some visual elements on the Game Boy Advance's screen when you play it, but they're basically incidental. The whole point is really that you know you've got your headphones in, your stereo headphones, and then basically you're kind of using those kind of sounds to you're going on a kind of journey, as it were, in that you get a sound comes in and then you have to you sort of balance it so that it's equal between the left and the right channels, and then you capture it and sort of lock that in place, and then you move on to the next sound, which is kind of moving around until you lock that in place, so sort of sounds come in and out of, I don't know whether you'd necessarily call it music, you know, but it's like a kind of audio experience, ambient kind of experience, you know, like you said, this sort of progression of the sounds that come in, the sounds that go out, and the kind of audio journey that creates or whatever. Yeah, that's it. So it's not a lot there, but it is kind of a relaxing experience and kind of a novelty of, you know, interacting with something without having to use your eyes at all. And I can imagine you could do something analogous to that, but based around the feedback granted to you by you know, the rumble, the tactile feedback, but yeah, considering Sound Voyager was like the biggest dead end in the Bit Generations kind of line, I guess maybe it doesn't speak too well of you know, how successful such a thing could be. It does, that kind of thing does make me think, like, and there probably are certain games that make use of these sorts of things, but again, I'm kind of not necessarily, you know, first of all, don't play very, very many worthy games because there are so many on Switch, but also not necessarily even with the Rumble opportunity these days. But I feel like, you know, if you're in a kind of game where you're maybe like shooting a bunch of targets and all that, there could be, you know, like, I like the idea of maybe adding to, especially because it would go with the gyro aiming feature of,
right.
Joy-Cons, like, where you as you sort of pass the reticle over a particular target, you get that kind of feedback from the rumble of like, okay, warmer, hot. You are right on the spot now. Yeah. Fire. Kind of like a tactile version of Darth Vader's targeting computer. You know, I have you now. You know, and of course he doesn't because his wingman sucks. But, and he, only that is, he is not at fault for anything. But also that kind of targeting, I think, well, and like I said, maybe there is some of that with some of the games that use both gyro aiming and HD rumble that I'm not like thinking of or just haven't experienced firsthand. But I feel like it's kind of using multiple of the elements that they put in the Joy-Con to good use if you do something like that. But that's very much just like augmenting an existing experience rather than like, oh, you could only do this with HD rumble, which of course is more what they were going for in the 1-2 Switch kind of era, but quickly gets forgotten when you get out of launch window world.
If there was some ability for various Joy-Con to recognize where the other one is, then you could do like Marco Polo style, like emergent gameplay where I'm using the Joy-Con to like track where my opponents are in space, but because they don't know where the other ones are, unfortunately it limits, basically I can't convince you to put on a blindfold and play Switch games, unfortunately.
we're getting into sports friends territory here, aren't we?
A little bit, yeah. Like that, I mean, that's kind of where you end up.
Yeah, sports friends was like this. Eventually, like it was a title published on Sony hardware, but it contained Johann Sebastian Joust, which was this kind of this phenomenon at various PAX events. Because it was a game that was played exclusively with, like, I don't know, a music system or a PC playing music and the Move controller.
Originally, I think it was Wii remotes. I think it was like in the most primitive version of it. Yeah.
And people were kind of like trying to knock the controller out of each other's hands. I have that right? It's been forever.
I think you just had to slap it. I think it just had to register that it's so you also couldn't jerk your arm too fast.
Right. Yes.
And it was basically just tag. And if the controller detected too much vibration, it went off and you were out.
Yeah. Something like Game & Wario kind of did stuff a little bit with the rumble where you would play a game, but the rumble would indicate like, oh, you're actually like, you're the cheater in this game. You're the, you know, people need to find you. It's a little bit different, but at the same time, like I don't know what you can do with rumble because I don't have imagination. the problem is that apparently Nintendo doesn't either.
I think it's just hard.
Yeah, well, yeah, obviously. Also, like, if you're gonna have, how do you demonstrate that HD Rumble as a like a marketing point? You know,
it's
like
not
you
the
can't.
Easiest.
It's not. Yeah, like oh, we put all money into this, and like what's this? Oh, it's a Rumble. And yeah, I can't show it to you in an ad.
That was,
you know,
one of the reasons why, you know, it did call to mind the stereoscopic 3D thing with the 3DS, because it's like you, in a commercial, you can't really show the stereoscopic feature because everyone's just watching that on a 2D screen, you know. So I obviously have these like silly kind of visualizations or, you know, kind of extrapolations of like, oh, he's, you know, Reggie getting set on fire by Bowser coming out of the system or whatever. It you know, it doesn't actually sell what the feature does. You have to kind of show it to people, and those things, you know, don't market well, and then by extension they don't tend to sell that well either.
Yeah, I gotta say, like, Nintendo Labo and, like, building a little quote-unquote, like, car or drone with the controllers through the HD Rumble, like, you could control them to
yeah,
make them go forward or whatever.
Yeah, the differential vibration could make it, yeah, make the cardboard move.
That is pretty inventive, and I don't know. It pushes pretty far the idea for HD Rumble, yeah. I find.
No, it's not as if they didn't go places with it. It's just how far did those places take Nintendo, you know, to commercially or any other way. It just didn't seem to be that fruitful.
I've got you're taking me to where my last idea is, and it's in the realm of what I just talked about. So it requires the use of both Joy-Con. So it uses the Labo VR set with a new cardboard piece that you put on top, and some filters on there so it doesn't have to be mounted to your head. So that the Joy-Con will be mounted, because the Labo VR kit has them mounted. The new piece allows the IR sensor to point out in front of your face. And it now becomes your eyes. And so all you get is predator vision on the screen of it. And the vibration of the hand is also like when the IR sensor detects motion and you start sweeping around, the more motion it's detecting will vibrate in the direction it's seeing it. So it kind of gives you some extra hints that you're seeing things. Because when you're looking out in IR, if everybody's standing really still, you might still see body heat. But you'll see something. But if they start moving, you want that extra like sonar effect.
You haven't thought it through though, because what if you do this when someone's at a mud bath?
Oh, that's, you know, that's, I don't consider that. I think that's just extra like commitment to win it. that's somebody who says I want to win, and just going for it, and it's a good for them, you know. Absolutely good for them. If they're devoted to the cause, get after it. If they go like stand in front of the refrigerator for a while so they throw off a little bit less IR than their opponents, I mean, that's just the want how. The want how? That's the know how. That's just the want. You know, we talk about what the fire in their belly. That's what that is. So yeah, that's the reviving of it. All right. Well, that is going to do it for emails this week and for the year. So again, emails go to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. That is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We're going to do some plugs real quick and get us out of here. Guillaume, your radio trivia episode's out now.
It is, and it is excellent. So go listen to it.
Yeah, it's you're right. It is, and I can't give way into the games yet, but it's fun. I had fun with this one. This is episode... had the number in front of me, now I don't. 176, Anger Management, came out like an hour before episode 751 did.
Right.
So that is out. Next week, I will be appearing over on GX's Twitch stream, the Spin Dash on Twitch. You'll see it'll be talked about in the NWR Discord, I'm sure. Let me look up the time, because he told me and I forgot because I am a professional. It is on, you know what, it'd be easier if I didn't have this in a tiny little preview image. Wednesday, December 29th at 7 p.m. Eastern. 2021 year in review. GX attempts to explain the year that was to a special guest that is distinctly not a Sonic fan. All caps, this episode may have explicit language. And he's right. This is on twitch.tv/SonicStadium, not the Spin Dash. That's his personal. So this is on the Sonic Stadium Twitch. God help us all. Greg, you are off this week from the Seren streams, correct?
Yeah, you'll be reconvening after Christmas at some point, and moving into for the 2010s.
Yeah,
those are the halcyon days.
this is where it really gets into, like, what do you mean there's still 27 games left for this year?
The first time you've ever thought, come on, Wii U, bring it all to a sweet, sweet conclusion.
It's like the sweet release of death.
Yes.
This is twitchtv.serenmcn. And then last plug, I think, unless y'all have something I'm not thinking of. A very serious article was posted at Tender World Report this week. called Meta. Oh, actually, the full title, because I couldn't fit the full title on the main page, is A Businessman's Prerogative: Meta NFT and Repeating Other Meaningless Buzzwords to Make Me Money.
That's it. This is another one of your Jerry Maguire mission statements, isn't it?
It is. I want to say two things. One, I produced a lot of images for this thing. Like, most of the images I made. That does not include the picture of somebody looking incredibly disgusted in the ad for Meta that was paid for by Meta to look excited about their product, which it just cracks me the hell up. Or the video of Dave Bautista forgetting his lines in the middle of a wrestling event, despite the fact he'd been a professional actor for 10 years at that point, and just screaming the phrase, "Show me what I want, give me what I want," over and over again because he forgot his lines. Why this article about NFTs, Mario Kart, Pokemon, and also Dave Bautista exists? Well, somebody had to write it. And that somebody, turns out, is me. So you can go read that over at NintendoWorldReport.com. It's listed as an editorial, which is probably an abuse of that word.
Mission statement, again.
Yeah.
Get a new category on the site just for that.
Personal.
Every time you wake up in the middle of the night and feel the need to write one of these, or whatever the hell happened to Tom Cruise in that movie that forces him to lose his job. Well, it's a cautionary tale, James.
At one point, there was a line that said something like, "If you don't understand what I'm getting at right now, I regret to inform you you're already 1,500 words into the article." But I cut that down and just said, "Unfortunately for you, this means I will continue to write this article." I wrote it in about 35 minutes, which is actually what's horrifying.
Yeah.
Is that it just blew out of my hands in 35 minutes. Yeah, if nothing else, I was informed by someone whom alleges to care about me, quote, "That picture of Vulpix is very cute," was their response to the article. So,
Vulpix is cute. I mean, how are you going to have a picture of Vulpix that isn't cute?
Well, you can find that out at NintendoWorldReport.com. I think that does it for plugs this week. Greg, what's our music to wrap it up?
Well, I thought, you know, as we are sort of leaving the year, or just recently, Kirby's Return to Dreamland turned 10 years old, leaving that year and joining what we know from our first email today is going to be the year of Kirby, apparently, and I'm sure it'll be every bit as, you know, kind of fruitful, bountiful as the year of Luigi. I thought we'd
The year of Luigi was the next year, so I guess the next year is the year of Waddle Dee.
Yeah, fair. We will go with something from the Kirby's Return to Dreamland soundtrack, which is very nice. So this is sort of in the lineage of Kirby sort of acronym named Final Boss themes. Kirby Final Boss has got all the way back to like Kirby's Adventure are just like incredibly kind of lavish affairs. And they have to have music to match. And, yeah, there's been a number of really good ones of these over the years. Like, I think Triple Deluxe is excellent. I think that's might be called Flowered or something. I forget, but this is called Crowned, for the final boss of, Kirby's Return to Dreamland, or Kirby Adventure Wii, if you're in Europe and like utilitarian names. Yeah, a very, very cool game, which really kind of helped get me, firmly on board with the traditional Kirby fare.
Hey, Greg, nice. I'm going to ask a question, and maybe you can figure out why I'm wondering this. Is Nintendo of Europe run out of Germany? I just have the sneaking suspicion.
Yeah, it sure is.
Gee, I wonder why I thought that. All right, well, on that... Oh, no, wait, one more plug. Patreon.com/NWR. That's three this month. Get it. $1. All right, on that.
Yeah, if you're a lapsed patron, get back. We're back. So
we're back.
You're right. Actually getting the content you're paying for.
That's right.
You're welcome.
That's right. We took a break and you took a break. Now it's time to pay the piper. That's us, I guess. I don't know. Patreon.com/NWR. And on that, have a happy holidays, everybody. We will see you next year. Thank you for listening. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye.
Bye-bye.